Welcome to Radio Curious and part two in our series about solitary confinement in the California prisons. I'm Barry Vogel. This is our second conversation with Stephen Sifra, a 38-year-old undergraduate student at the University of California at Berkeley, who spent almost 16 years in prison, beginning when he was 14 years old. For almost 8 of those years, he was held in solitary confinement. Our first conversation ended when he was about to explain the importance of giving voice to a segment of the population that ends up in prison and is otherwise not heard, who they are and why they are there. In this, the second conversation recorded from his home in Berkeley, California, on September 14, 2013, Stephen Sifra tells more of his personal story, his background and reflections, and how he has chosen to turn his life around.
I was in jail and prison much of my life, and from the very beginning, you know, when I was 9 years old, and even earlier, I think maybe even 8, I didn't have the privilege of having great parenting. Like, my parents weren't really around; they weren't around at all. And so, you know, I was given the opportunity to get in some mischief, and we broke into a garage, and, you know, we stole a couple items, and, you know, after the other shoe dropped and the LAPD investigated and they came to my house and, you know, they got me in an interrogation room, they took me away in handcuffs and got me in an interrogation room and, you know, gave me the riot act about rolling on my buddies and going to jail. And That whole exercise was the first piece in a long and destructive and costly experience between me and the justice system in California. When there's a kid who is breaking into garages and, you know, is basically allowed to do whatever they want. That, for me, when I see that, when I see kids around, kids that age that are on that track, what comes up for me isn't, oh, there's good people in this world, there's bad people in this world. This kid is probably one of those bad people, and we need to put the screws to them, you know, to, you know, stamp out this behavior or, you know, make them pay. For me, what comes up is, we have some social issues here. Like, this person isn't getting what they need. This 9-year-old person isn't, their needs are not getting met. And so for me personally, that picked up steam right away. So, I mean, for me, that's not a crime issue. You know, if there's a crime issue in that scenario, it's not centered on the child. And so when I ended up, you know, in adult prison, what I found was everybody there pretty much had the same story.
Of an abandoned childhood.
Yeah, troubled, you know, variations on the troubled childhoods, on the lifelong, you know, contact with law enforcement, drug addiction. When I first broke into that garage, I wasn't a drug addict.
How old were you then? 9?
I was probably 8, because it was before I started using drugs. I started using drugs in earnest. I started smoking crack around 9 or 10, and I started smoking weed and drinking and doing crack every day by the time I was 11. And by 13, I was, you know, it had been years. I've been using for years.
So taking into consideration the time that you spent in solitary confinement as a juvenile and adult, and your life pre-contact with the juvenile authorities and then the adult authorities, from the point of view of where you are now, a student at the University of California at Berkeley, where are you going with this? What are your observations and considerations about what you think needs to be done?
Well, first of all, it's a resource issue. We have the resources, and by we, I mean us Californians.
The government has the economic resources to make changes.
Absolutely. The resources are available. I went to my son's open house the other day, and he goes to one of the best schools around. Like, people, you know, come to this area to get their kids into this public school. And, you know, you go in there, and the staff there, the teachers, everybody's just so aware. They're so awake. They're evolved. They're like, we have... your child's education is just the most important thing in the world to us. And almost the entire open house was a shakedown for cash, for glue sticks, and for napkins. And thank goodness that the people in the city, the people in that school, they have those resources, and they, you know, they have a little bit of flexibility. They can help out financially. My family, we have a little bit of financial flexibility, we can help out. But that's not the case in other parts of my community, in Oakland. You know, people don't have, they're living on a couple $100 a month. And the writing is on the wall. I mean, we know that people with educations tend to not go to jail. You know, we know this. And we know that, you know, right now, Jerry Brown, our governor, is in the process of raiding our state's coffers. He wants $400 million this year for prisons. And this price tag is going to balloon over the next generation, because what happened was the Supreme Court told them, you have to reduce your prison population, because the state is overwhelmingly in favor of letting low-level drug offenders out of prison. It's really expensive. It's just tearing communities apart. We all know it. So meanwhile, Jerry Brown has hundreds of millions of dollars to keep these people in prison. My son's school doesn't have money for napkins or glue sticks.
And at the same time, the federal court based in Sacramento is ordering a significant release of prisoners.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, is they can't make Jerry Brown release anybody, but they can compel him to relieve the overcrowding, like actually let people out of jail. So they can say, okay, look, you have by this date to reduce your population, and he doesn't have to let them out. He can. We do this thing in California now called realignment. Basically, what it amounts to is sending state prisoners back to the county jail where they came from to do their prison time.
The other option is to build more prisons, which it sounds like what the governor here wants to do.
Exactly. And then that's the other option. So the long-term option is he wants to build more prisons. Jerry Brown received $2 million from the California Correctional Peace Officers Association for his campaign. And this is a guy supposed to be a progressive. He's supposed to be, you know, his platform was supposed to be like a progressive community-based platform. But he's taken this money from the prison guards union, and surprise, he wants to build more prisons. I mean, just follow the money. So, you know, when people ask me things like, we have this problem, we have this social problem, what are we going to do about it? You know, people are breaking the law. And of course, you know, California, we have 35 full-scale prison facilities. Okay, 20-plus of them have been built in the last 20 years.
So you were telling us before that one of your goals is to get a PhD and to teach and write on these issues. I think you have just expressed your goal about early childhood education, more parental contact with children. How do you propose to implement those goals?
Right. Well, so first of all, getting an education, we know that education is power. You know, we know that when people learn terms and when people learn social constructions and they learn, when their vocabulary is increased, they get the ability to look at the world and to look at things in a different way. So before I was in school, when I was in jail, you know, I was in jail. And I was like, okay, criminal, worst of the worst, blah, blah, blah. But then when I got out and I started learning about these practices, and I heard terms like mass incarceration and the new Jim Crow and the old Jim Crow and, you know, about vagrancy laws and things like that, then I can look at the world in a different way, you know. But before that, there was my ability to, you know, kind of critically analyze the world around me was very limited, if non-existent. So for me, putting these tools in the hands of people, primarily children, that's, you know, who I think it starts there. And it doesn't start, for me, it doesn't necessarily start with kids before they come in contact with the law. If, you know, somebody had, you know, believed in me and saw the potential in me that that man saw when I was 30 and invested in me in that way when I was younger, I don't know, maybe I wouldn't have experienced, you know, prison the way I did. But, you know, people that get educations, they basically they're given an option whether or not they want to continue to live. And most people choose not to. We know that people with two-year degrees, you know, don't go to prison, you know, 70% don't reoffend. Whereas the opposite is true for people that don't have a two-year degree. They do reoffend 70%. So, you know, what does a two-year degree cost this community? You know, it's, okay, let's say on the high end, let's say it's a couple hundred thousand dollars. What we're talking about is creating another opportunity for somebody to contribute to their community instead of, let's say, they go and spend 20 years in prison, you know, at, you know, $50,000 a year. That's $1 million.
Well, this what you're saying is obviously in contradiction to the attempts by some members of our society who wish to reduce taxes, realign how money is being taken from individual citizens by the government to meet community needs, education being one of them. Before we continue in our conversation with Stephen Cifra, I want to say that you are listening to Radio Curious in the second of two conversations with Mr. Cifra, who spent about 12 years of his life in juvenile and state prisons in California, 8 of those years in solitary confinement. He's now a student at the University of California in Berkeley. You are listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Stephen, let's go back to the issue of solitary confinement. And I want to ask you about the psychological consequences of solitary confinement.
Yeah. Well, the way that I've been impacted is unique to me. And, you know, I am one of the really fortunate people who experienced long-term solitary confinement and had the facilities, the faculties to care for myself, you know, by drawing or by reading or by, you know, reading books that had, you know, spiritual content and they could teach me how to sit thoughtfully and, you know, not spin out and go crazy, things like that. But that's, so that's not the case for everybody. Many people in solitary confinement are already mentally ill. Our state doesn't have an infrastructure for caring for the mentally ill other than prison. So if a mentally ill person goes to jail, which happens pretty much universally, they end up in solitary confinement right away. And they don't have the ability to do the kinds of things that I had the opportunity to do. They, you know, a person who's in full-blown, you know, schizophrenic, affective, paranoid state and is refusing medication because they don't have the ability to care for themselves, you know. and the people that are caring for them are mean. They're prison guards. You know, they're walking around with guns and handcuffs. You know, they're not there to care for people. So, for me, the mental impact, the emotional impact, it was highly damaging. It's terrible. I deal with it every day.
What happened to you?
What's that?
What was the emotional impact to you specifically?
I'm a wreck. You know, here I am. I'm 10 years removed from solitary confinement, and I can see, I experience the effects every day. You know, I have a hard time dealing with social situations. I get really nervous and paranoid and tense around. You know, it could be anything from grocery shopping to, going out to eat or just hanging out with friends. I can't sleep. I never sleep through the night. There hasn't been a single night since I've left solitary confinement where I've slept through the night. I typically wake up, four times a night. The consequences, they touch every area of my life.
So knowing the consequences and knowing how they touch you, are you able to use that as a lead to overcome the experience, the post-traumatic stress experience that you have now?
Well, I do things to take care of myself now, tools that I didn't have before.
Can you share those with us?
Yeah. So I journal. I have a mentor. You know, I'm in a 12-step program. So, I do an inventory of my behavior and my beliefs and my thoughts, and I match those up with my values, and I see where there's contradictions, and I can adjust my behavior in that way, and I can adjust my perspective incrementally in that way, so that when I go to class and it's full of 18-year-old kids, And I can come back and I can reflect later on that day and I go, oh, you know what? Yeah, you went to class, it was full 18-year-old kids, you thought you were going to perish, you thought you weren't okay, you thought you were going to be attacked, you know, you had those feelings of anxiety. Look, you made it through, nothing there is going to hurt you, you can do this, you know, you can go back tomorrow. And over, you know, with enough of that kind of reflection, things do become, easier to take.
Let's talk about where you are in your university studies now.
Well, I'm an undergrad. I just finished up the work on my English major, so I just have to, finish up some credits and then take a few elective classes and get my bachelor's degree in English. But what's really interesting or kind of a cool development is doing work. So I started a research project with an independent research project with some staff through the English and Ethnic Studies Department, where I'm going to be allowed to research and look at the last California prisoner hunger strike, solitary confinement. And it's my hope that I'm going to start to be able to use this research approach or this research avenue to build a PhD program for myself.
Well, good luck to you.
Thanks.
You've given some thought about what other people who have not had the experience in life that you have had can do to overcome the issues that we discussed earlier about the need for greater education, the need for greater parental involvement in early childhood.
Well, I believe in public education. I believe that public education is it's everything for somebody that doesn't have anything. Just the more people know, the better off we are. The parental involvement, some people don't have parents. some people don't have, some people's parents are deceased, they're incarcerated, or they're drug addicts, or they're, for whatever reason, they don't have parents. So just having this, you know, this kind of goal that we're going to get more parents involved, that's oversimplified for me. I think the community has a moral obligation to itself. I have a moral obligation to my community that that I participate in my community in a meaningful and be helpful and contributory. So, you know, if when I go to my kid's school and they say, "Hey, we need parents to participate," it's what they're saying is, some of our parents, we have a need for a parenting presence. So if you have the ability to bring that parenting presence in a way that can help where there are deficits, please do. You know, and so I'm uniquely positioned to do that. So for me, it's a matter of decency.
Stephen Sifra, let's talk about grassroots involvement in relationship to a recent experience that you've had that might promote or help people understand how they can become involved in these issues.
Okay, Barry. So often when I'm talking with my friends, a comment that people will make is, if it was that big of an issue, somebody would be doing something about it. Or another kind of sentiment is just this one of impotency, like it's things are messed up and there's really nothing we can do. And I don't agree with either one of those ideas. And I have a kind of a quick anecdote that I would like to share that has stuck with me. It's a very powerful moment in my own activism and my own grassroots involvement. And so what happened was we were on the steps of the Capitol, and we're trying to get people involved with this mass incarceration issue, and we had the mock shoe cell out there, the scale, the full-size shoe cell. And after the demonstration, we all went inside and stood in front of Jerry Brown's office. And there was a CHP outside and to keep us out, and they were very adamant. They were not going to give us admission to Jerry Brown's office. But what happened was those law enforcement, you know, these all-powerful henchmen, I guess, they were nice guys. They looked decent enough. They said that they would go inside and talk with Jerry and see if we could gain admission if we just promised not to chant. And actually, we did gain admission. They allowed a small contingent of people to go in and talk to the governor's aides and present their issues on the spot. And it was based on law enforcement's fear of the people. They did not want the people to chant. And that told me everything I needed to know about the power of people taking time out of their lives, out of their very busy lives, and becoming involved in their communities.
What is the message?
The message is that we do have the power to affect change. We do have a voice. And when we get together, it doesn't even take very many of us. And when we get together, people pay attention. You know, people aren't going to pay attention if you just drop your little ballot in the box and just wait for somebody else to deal with it. That's not enough, you know. We already know that the guy with the most money wins. You know?
Well, Stephen Sifra, I think you may have just answered the question that I like to ask at the end of each program about a eureka or an aha moment.
Uh-huh.
If you haven't, tell us another.
Oh, that's good with me.
Okay,
yeah.
Then let's move on to perhaps a little more specific, if you could, on what you would like to do with the remainder of your one precious life.
Okay, so, you know, I'm in school, and it's, you know, I believe that getting a college degree, getting a PhD will give me access to the people who do have the ability to affect change. And I think most of those people are decent, and I think most of those people do want to, you know, be of service, politicians and things like that. I don't think they're, you know, to a man, you know, bought and paid for. I want to get access to these people and start to work with them to kind of change the idea of how we look at our social problems and start to move away from this, you know, cookie cutter, you know, one size fits all prison solution to all of our social problems.
And finally, Stephen Sifra, is there a book that you can recommend to our listeners?
A book that I would recommend. A book that has really been important to me and has helped me a lot throughout my life, called We're All Doing Time, from Bo Lazoff of the Human Kindness Foundation. And, yeah, he passed away last year, and it's a good book.
Stephen Sifra, thank you again for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thanks, Barry.
Stephen Sifra is a 38-year-old undergraduate student at the University of California at Berkeley, who, beginning at the age of 14, spent almost 16 years in prison. About half of that time was in solitary confinement. The book he recommends is We Are All Doing Time, A Guide to Getting Free, by Bo Lazoff and the Dalai Lama. This interview was recorded on September 14th, 2013. Over 400 Radio Curious programs may be found on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free as my gift to you. I hope you enjoy them. Our address is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. And email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is our assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.